So this is the big question. Can the European Union be reformed? And in particular, can it, from our left-wing perspective, can it become democratized in such a way that it becomes part of the solution and not part of the problem?
Yeah.
At the moment, we agree entirely it's part of the problem. Let me take it a bit further. I like your analogy with the Soviet Union and the old communists would defend saying, well, but we have a small problem, and you saying that, no, that was not a small problem. It was part of the design.
Yeah.
Exactly as in the case of the European Union. But I want to be a bit more specific. The British state, the American state, how were these states brought into being? It was the result of centuries, of decades, of class conflict, of conflict between different vested interests. Initially, and that's what produced the Magna Carta in this country, it was the barons against the king. Then you had the merchants that came in with their own separate interests, fighting the other two sides. Then you had the proletariat. You had different parts of capital with its own vested interests, like financial capital, the banking sector versus industrial capital, manufacturing. And the state emerged as part of an evolutionary process for regulating these conflicts with sovereignty, with democratic processes, which became important because they were more efficient at regulating these conflicts. Now, compare and contrast that kind of system of governance, state, with the European Union. How was the European Union created? It was created in the late 1940s, designed and effected in the early 1950s, 1950 onwards, as a cartel of heavy industry. Yeah. The first name of the European Union was the European Community of Coal and Steel. So, the manufacturers, the heavy industries of coal and steel in Belgium, in Holland, in Germany, in eastern France, and in northern Italy, became one cartel. And it happened under the stewardship of the United States of America and the new dealers who were running the show at the time. And it was a very important part of that global post-war design, which was a very interesting design, and I'm not criticizing it, I'm simply stating it as a fact. Now, the problem is that, you know, every cartel has its administration, like OPEC, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, has its own administration. That cartel had its administration, and it was located in Brussels. So Brussels began not as the government of a state, but it began as the administration minding the interests of a cartel, the purpose of which was to regulate competition, to prevent effectively competition between those industrialists, and that cartel then became expanded.
So it's like a big mafia family controlling...
Yeah, so they co-opted the French farmers, it's called the Common Agricultural Policy, then they co-opted the bankers, then they expanded geographically, but it still remained a technocracy in Brussels with deep contempt for democracy. Democracy was simply, for them, a process of elections that would validate their power to make decisions independently of the demos, or the demi, the plural of demos. Now, it is very important, at least from the perspective of those of us who are unfortunate enough to be living under the euro, to understand why the euro emerged. A cartel requires price stability. So OPEC is all about regulating the price of oil. The cartel of coal, steel, and all the other commodities that began to participate in that had to keep prices constant. That's the whole point of the raison d'etre of a cartel. Now, to keep prices constant when you have different countries, the exchange rates between those countries have to be maintained. But it was okay for the first 20 years because the Americans maintained those exchange rates at constant levels on behalf of the whole of the Western world. It was called the Bretton Woods system that was inaugurated in 1944. It was designed, it was inaugurated a bit later. John Maynard Keynes had played a role in designing it. His ideas were better than the ones that were used in the end, but that's another story. This system collapsed in 1971. And the Deutschmark value vis-à-vis the Italian lira, the French mark, started fluctuating. So the cartel that was the European common market was under pressure, and it was very close to collapse. They had to stabilize the exchange rate, so they started the process of fixing them. It didn't work. Britain escaped one of those attempts to fix the exchange rates when Norman Lamont got you out of the Eurozone, of the Maastricht Treaty. You remember, it was the instance that made George Soros a very rich man in the early 1990s. And then when that didn't work, they tried something much more drastic and radical, a common currency. But when Thatcher was completely right in her last appearance in the House of Commons as Prime Minister, that day after she had been dismissed by the vegetables in 10 Downing Street. That's what she used to call them, right? So in that appearance in the House of Commons, she made the point that who controls interest rates and monetary policy is a political matter. Monetary policy is about the politics of a country, and the Eurozone is about the politics of Europe. I think this is more or less verbatim what Thatcher said. As a left-winger who spent his youth picketing against every policy Mrs. Thatcher had introduced, there is an elegant joy to be had from eulogizing that particular intervention by Margaret Thatcher. She was completely right. So what happens therefore is this. If you try to graft a common currency on top of the administration of a cartel, you end up with a horrible story. You end up with, firstly, a highly inefficient monetary system, one that creates Ponzi growth and an unsustainable boom at the beginning. That was the period between 2000 and 2008. And then a bust, which puts all the burden of the catastrophe on the weakest of shoulders in Greece, in Spain, in Ireland, and in those countries amongst the weakest of citizens. And the whole thing becomes a wound that festers, and it is impossible to heal as long as the administration in Brussels and in Frankfurt, because we built the central bank there, continues to be in denial of the architectural design faults of this thing. So far what I've been doing is I've been arguing against my thesis. Because my thesis, as Slavoj said, is that it's a little bit like Hotel California, the last verse. You can check out of the European Union, you will get a chance to do it in the referendum, but you cannot really leave Europe. You cannot leave the European Union. Your trade will be with the European Union. The European Union will be designing the industrial standards. The labor standards that you are going to have here by Tory governments, if you follow the advice of David Cameron, are always going to be slightly worse than the ones in Europe. Not that the ones in Europe are any good. The environmental standards are going to be a race to the bottom, which will intensify climate change, will intensify the damage that we're doing to the planet. So my conclusion is this. The European Union, as it is detrimental to the interests of Europeans. But its demise and fragmentation from decisions by the Brits, the Greeks, the Portuguese to get out of this, the fragmentation of this edifice that we have created is going to bring about a recessionary Germany, Holland, Baltics, Poland, Slovakia, Czech Republic, and a stagflationary Latin Union, including Greece. I don't know where Greece will be in this terrible scheme of things. Imagine what will happen when the working poor in Germany become unemployed poor. Imagine what will happen when the total GDP, gross domestic product of the Eurozone, starts sliding as a result of the fragmentation of the European Union. Britain is going to be dragged down with a Europe that is fading, a Europe that is descending very quickly into a postmodern 1930s. So, either we democratize the European Union, or we are going to be facing the horrors of a new Great Depression without the prospects of a new deal like the one that an aristocrat like Franklin Roosevelt had the power and the political authority to effect in the United States.
Okay, before Slavoj intervenes, could you specify, because Could you tell us, that would probably be a question and we will have an opportunity for a Q&A, so if you have answers, you can slowly start to prepare them. You've been part of the Eurogroup, you've been criticizing it pretty openly, and I would even go so far to say that Yanis Varoufakis is a whistleblower as well, the same as Julian Assange, Edward Snowden, and so on, in the sense that he revealed what is actually happening at this so-called institution called Eurogroup. So you have seen this. Can you tell us actually from your experience, but very shortly or very long, so Slavoj doesn't have an opportunity to talk, to tell us what would it concretely mean, what would it concretely mean to democratize Europe?
I will try to be succinct. Firstly, having experienced the Eurogroup and the secrets, it's like a secret society, and the fact that there are no rules governing the behavior of its participants is another grievous issue here. What I would like to do, in the first week that we have any authority to make any changes, is how about live streaming all the meetings of the European Union Council and the Eurogroup? Yeah. I have no doubt, having witnessed them, that the outcome of these meetings would be very different if the citizens of Europe could hear and watch their leaders in action. And this is something that doesn't take a new treaty, a new constitution, institutional change, and let them tell us why they would resist the idea of allowing those who voted them to be there to represent them to take a peek at that which they propose on behalf of their electors. That's the first thing. The second thing, that's in the very short term.
Transparency is the first point.
Transparency. But you know what? It's such a crucial point. Because there is no easier way than creating an autocracy than by keeping people who have a periodic right to vote in the dark. And the powers that be know that. I think that it's time that the rest of us realized. The second thing that we should do, look, we have institutions in Europe. They're very badly designed. The European Central Bank was designed as if it was designed in order to cause a crisis, not to prevent it. The European Stability Mechanism, I personally prefer to refer to it as the European Instability Mechanism. The banking union that we've created is in reality a banking disunion. We have terrible institutions, but nevertheless, we can redeploy them without changing any of the rules, without changing the treaties, within a very few number of weeks, maybe 2-3 months, we can redeploy them in order to stabilize, not make any huge improvements, but stabilize the situation when it comes to the crisis of public debt, of underinvestment, of the banking system, and to do something in order to alleviate poverty. Imagine for 1 second, if poor families throughout Europe, or the Eurozone at least, were to receive a check from the European Central Bank signed by Mario Draghi that would allow them not to cash it for money, but to go to the supermarket and buy food so that they could put food on the table at that night so that their kids wouldn't go hungry in Greece, in Slovenia, in Eastern Germany for that matter. That would have an amazing unifying effect. I can tell you, even the whole debate about refugees would change. If these checks happen, now you may say, but this is such a left-wing utopia. It's not. It's what happens in the United States. They're called food stamps. And they get distributed. And you know what? In the United States, the official level of poverty at the moment is about 13-14%. People who are below the level of poverty. Without the food stamps, it would have been 26%. You have no idea what a unifying effect those food stamps have throughout the United States of America. It is connected to the capacity of even poor Americans to be able to say, we the people, and to actually mean it, something we in Europe cannot do. The third thing that I would like to do is to set a target for, let's say, 2 years from now, to have a constitutional assembly, where we will start tabula rasa, forget the European Parliament, it's not a real parliament, it's a very interesting job creation scheme for people who don't have the capacity to legislate, an assembly of citizens who get elected in order to discuss during 6 months, 12 months, one great question. How do we want Europe to be governed? And here I will invoke Tony Benn. The most important thing about democratizing any regime, whether it's in Britain, in Europe, in Slovenia, wherever, is to be able to ask those who make important decisions over you three or four important questions. What powers do you have? How did you get them? What use do you make of them? And how can we get rid of you? This is what the Constitutional Assembly should be able to answer. And let's also agree that whatever that Constitutional Assembly decides should be effected, implemented in Europe in the next 10 years. And I would like the British people to be part of that attempt, rather than to think that you can retreat, you can actually add propellers to your beautiful island and sail away into a non-existent global economy that will replace the European Union for you.